Okay, Tom, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. So this is joint work with Rafael Mendoza, who is known to some people here. So he seems to be keeping, originally from Mexico, but he's been here for a number of years working at ALGO, and then he came to us, Northwestern. Now he's at UT Austin, so he seems to be moving south. Back out. Okay, so this is sort of the first. Why is there is an arrow? But okay, yeah. So there is sort of two parts to the talk. Why is only one screen moving? The other screen is not moving. Is that by design or is it? Mm-hmm. Shouldn't be.
So, yeah, we should be making sure that we mirror the two. Okay, try now, copy from the right.
So that you can
know for you the current line.
Yeah.
Okay, so the first part of the talk is sort of a brief survey on single name unified credit equity modeling, sort of a little history review and a couple of my own papers. Early on the subject and sort of general context, and then the second part of the talk is a recent paper that of Rafael and mine that we just went through another revision this summer, which is available. It's available on the web. So that's multi-name unified credit equity modeling. So the single name credit equity modeling is by now quite a widely known topic with quite a lot of work done over the past 5 years or so, but multi-name credit equity modeling is something that is fairly new. In fact, I don't know anything in the literature, any other classes of models in this realm. So basically just a little bit of history on single names. So on single names, so basically what is unified credit equity modeling? Well, if you're in the structural sort of domain of structural models, then obviously everything is unified because the underlying fundamental state variable in the structural approach is the value of the firm, and then everything else, all corporate securities such as corporate bonds, equity, convertible bonds, and derivatives such as stock options and credit derivatives and everything basically are contingent claims on the value of the firm. So in the structural approach, obviously, everything is viewed as there's no such a thing as really separate credit and equity in some sense. It's all unified. But, of course, the difficulties with the structural models that, well, the value of the firm is not directly observable, and so it's quite a complex endeavor to really design structural models and calibrate them name by name to each individual firms. So reduced form models have been hugely popular, and as soon as you go to reduced form models, then you sort of have this disconnect between credit and equity. So on one hand, reduced form credit models, the fundamental state variable is, for example, default intensity. So you model default intensities, for example, as some sort of a process, and then you derive the solutions for credit derivatives, corporate spreads, and et cetera. So that's reduced form credit modeling. In the equity world, so at this point, you forget about the value of the firm and you model as a fundamental primitive the stock price, and the stock price is usually modeled as a strictly positive process, starting with the Black-Scholes, which is geometric Browning motion. Then you go to various diffusions with local volatility, you go to stochastic volatility models, you go to Levy models, and et cetera, et cetera. Now, if you think for a second, all of those models, like all those generation after generation of equity derivatives models, all of those processes have infinite lifetime. Okay, so the stock just keeps evolving. So all these jump models, all the Levy type models, all the stochastic volatility models, so they all primarily, I mean, there are some exceptions, but primarily they have, just like the Black-Scholes model, the stock just keeps going. It's a positive process. So now you have this immediate disconnect between the major classes of equity derivatives models and credit. So in credit, all you're interested in is that default event, that bankruptcy, that discrete event. And in the stock models, equity derivatives models, your stock just keeps going as a positive process. So this is the disconnect that existed between credit reduced form intensity-based credit models and equity derivatives models for a long time. The disconnect becomes particularly acute for convertible bonds. So convertible bonds, so it's a bond that can be converted to stock. So it's really silly to model a convertible bond on one hand where you worry about the bankruptcy of the firm, but on the other hand you use this process where the stock is going to evolve positive forever. So the tension becomes particularly acute in the convertible bond world. And not surprisingly, it's from the convertible bond literature, sort of that's where this unified credit equity models, as far as I understand it, emerged both in practice and in literature. And in practice, apparently they emerged much earlier than in literature, because I've seen a long time ago people on modeling and convertible arbitrage something along the lines that later appeared in academic literature as this unified credit equity framework. But as far as I know, for example, there's a paper, one of the early papers is Davis and Lischka on convertible bonds. And then there's a whole slew of papers. So basically the idea is that there is the defaultable stock is the fundamental state variable. And so the default intensity is actually taken to be a function of the stock price. And naturally, the lower the stock goes, the higher, so the more the firm is in distress, so the higher the default intensity. So, and that the high is the probability of this what's called jump to default. So that's basically the idea. So in the Davis and Lischka model, for example, so this was a convertible bond model where they had the stock, and then they had this intensity, which is the negative power of the stock price. So as the stock goes to zero, the intensity goes up, basically explodes. So asymptotically, a stock goes to zero, intensity goes to infinity. And when this jump arrives, you have the stock process, and you have this doubly stochastic Poisson process ticking in the background with this intensity, which is the negative power of the stock price. And then when this Poisson process jumps, so then the stock drops to zero. Okay, so that's that early model. And then there was a whole slew of convertible bond papers that valued convertible bonds in this framework, primarily various numerical, purely numerical methods. There were several papers, there's a whole number of papers on PDEs, was Forsythe and Detzel and Anderson, and there's a whole literature on that, on convertible model valuation. In particular, there was from 2002 up to about 2005, there was a whole bunch of papers on convertible bonds in this framework. So, and then, around about 2005, so I got interested in this empirical fact that came to my attention. So, this was the old days, okay, this is like, what is it, it's 2006, okay, this example is from 2006. So this is old days GM, you know, pre-bankruptcy and pre-everything. So this was the first sort of canary in the mine. This was the first time where people started really worrying about GM possibly going bankrupt. And the stock at that point was like, you know, this is the stock chart from, what is it, March 2005 to the beginning of 2006, so the stock was at like $36 high, and then it fell around 20, so that was the range, $20-$22, so that historical volatility was high, but was 46%, okay, that's just strike historical low, estimated over 12 months for this period. And then it came to my attention that the picture in the options on GM, on the stock options on GM, look like that, okay? Now, there were puts trading with strikes all the way down to $2.50. Now, GM is at like $22 at that point, okay? This is the old days, so, okay? So now, of course, we know what happened, but, so this is the old days. So this is like, So this is the range, okay? So it's like $21 or something like that. And while the stock is at 21, relatively short maturity puts with like 6 to 12 months are trading very actively with strikes of 10, 750, 5, and 250. Okay, and this is the implied volatility skew. So the implied volatility skew went, so the at the money saw like around 80% or something like that. And if you actually took those prices, the average between bid and ask for those $5 puts and $2.50 puts, you actually implied that Black-Scholes implied volatility was like 130%. I mean, so clearly there's a Black-Scholes model that goes out and leaves the room. I mean, there is nothing like with pure diffusion models. I mean, it's ridiculous. So so at that point, and not only that, okay, those puts with very, very low strikes, they were hugely actively traded, like hugely actively traded. I mean, the stock is at 22 and you have this open interest. So I remember that I looked up the open interest at that point and it was like this. It was something like, if you totaled open interest for this deep out of the money puts, Peter Carr calls them dunes now, deep out of money puts. So between strikes of 10 and 250, if you totaled open interest on those contracts, it was something like 130 million shares. The side, big open interest, a lot more than the at the money volatility, okay? So clearly practitioners already in those days realized that a deep out of the money put is nothing but a pure and simple credit derivative, okay? Because the value of that deep out of the money put based purely on, you know, the probability of the stock sort of slowly diffusing down there and getting in 6 months from 22 to below 250 is just small, okay, unless it's just like some crazy process. So really the value is all in this, like, catastrophic scenario that we call jump to default, okay? So essentially, clearly practitioners used those deep out of the money puts. It's plain and simple understood that this is just, it's a bet on bankruptcy, basically. It's like a credit derivative. And apparently there was some cross-hedging going on between debt and actually using those out-of-the-money puts as hedge for debt and some arbitraging between credit derivatives and equity derivatives and et cetera. So, Well, you get the strike. I mean, it's K minus S, right? So if it's 10 cents, I mean, if it gets to like 10 or 20 cents and it gets delisted, I mean, basically, you, because it has nothing to do with the company. The put is written by, like, let's say you write a put and I buy it, let's say, on GM, and then it goes bankrupt. So basically, I'm going to exercise it, and you have to, you know, so that's it. So that's the beauty of it. Okay, it's a K minus S. You know, if S is zero, then it's K. Okay, that's the payoff. Well, if you have a hugely in the money put, I mean, you get your value. I mean, now mathematically we approximate that in bankruptcy the stock is just worth zero and that's it at that very moment. It doesn't happen like this really. I mean, the stock could dribble there for like between some, usually drops below a dollar. It could dribble for a long, long time with some actually trade and pink sheets for some 10, 20, 30 cents, whatever it trades. And I mean, I'm going to exercise. If I have a strike of 20, so if I bought here the strike of 20 and it goes down to 10 cents, I mean, I'm, you know, going to pay like, you know, $19.90, you know, per share on exercise. I mean, what else are you going to do? So it's like credit default swap, basically. It's like pure and simple CDS, okay? Well, you can exercise at any time. I mean, if it's an American put, if it's a European put, then you have to wait until maturity, right? You can't claim it. But if it's an American, then you can exercise at any time. I mean, you can exercise on the day they actually, you know, file for bankruptcy, whatever. I mean, it's because it has nothing to do with, you know, the puts are not corporate securities. So that's the picture. So that's the picture that motivated my original interest in this. And so I had a paper that came out in 2006 that was titled Price and Equity Derivatives Subject to Bankruptcy in Mathematical Finance. So basically, the mathematical model is very simple that I did there. So I basically took that model pretty much out of Davis and Lischka. So it's like Black-Scholes, and then you have this doubly stochastic Poisson process with intensity which is a negative power of the stock price, where the stock is basically a geometric Brownian notion. There is a little twist, because if the stock does drop to zero, if there is the single drop to zero, then you have to compensate the drift to make the whole thing a martingale, so you add that intensity back to the drift, so you get that diffusion. So basically, I solved this in closed form using spectral expansion method. Was it some pretty neat mathematics that comes out of it in terms of how you actually solve it, and then basically I had a closed form solution for equity derivatives and closed form solution for corporate bonds, for example, or for credit derivatives. And so then I sort of said, okay, look, in convertible bonds, people understand this thing about unified credit equity modeling, but I mean, we should really be looking at it across the board. So it is, in some sense, there is almost no such thing as pure credit and pure equity. So out of the money put has an embedded credit derivative. So you can mathematically decompose a put as two parts. The part that pays K minus S, strike minus the price, if there is no default, and then the payout if there is default on debt. Okay? So in that piece that pays in the event of default, that's a credit part of the put. Okay? It's a simple stock option that's been trading forever on equity exchanges. Is really a credit derivative, you know, just as much as it is an equity derivative. And the more the put is out of the money, the deeper it is out of the money, the more it becomes a credit derivative. So you have to look at puts as basically containing information about credit as well as equity volatility. So because people usually extract volatility smile from options, and so here is smile, but really, in certain situations where you have this, people are worried about possibility of bankruptcy, this smile really reflects as much or more, a lot more than they usually, when you think about volatility smiles, you start thinking about various effects that lead to the smile, such as stochastic volatility and perhaps local jumps. But in here, this smile is primarily driven by that jump to default, by that possibility of default. And so we have this thing that when we look at equity options and look at the volatility skews and smiles, so we can also think about credit. So essentially, when you look at this very deep out of the money put, so its value is basically the value of that credit derivative. So it can actually imply the probability of default the equity options traders assign to, and in fact, if you looked at those, and I did those calculations, I didn't put it there and on the slide, the implied probability of default was very high at that point. It was something like 50% or more than that, like over a relatively short period of time. So you have information coming in from the equity derivatives markets shining light on credit, and you also may derive some information from the equity markets from the standpoint of value and credit derivatives. So that is kind of the program that where I got into this and sort of started this unified credit equity modeling for me. So, and then a little bit later, we had a paper with Peter Carr. So I did, at first I did this Black-Scholes with the, basically Black-Scholes model extended with the jump to default where the intensity is a negative power of the stock price. Then with Peter, we extended constant elasticity of variance model where you also have a local variance, sort of local volatility. So we extended that. So this is something that we call jump to default extended diffusion or JDCEV model. And then there was a lot of literature after that on this single name unified credit equity model. So Peter and Dilip Madan, so they had a paper where they estimated these classes of models jointly from stock options and CDS data, and then they did the next version, the next extension, where they introduced stochastic volatility model. So this is something that they call jump to default extended Heston stochastic volatility model. So this one is also an empirical paper that estimates these types of models jointly from CDS and from equity options. And there's a very recent paper that sort of further extends this with more stochastic volatility by Barakhtar and Young. So that's sort of the single name story. And there is a lot more. There's probably dozens of papers like this, and these classes of models, I know they are very, so practitioners know probably a lot more about them than I do at this point, because these classes of models have been in use quite substantially. So this literature, so this is basically diffusions, extending diffusion models, either local volatility or stochastic volatility with jump to default. Then when Rafa came to do his PhD, so he extended, he worked on introducing also jumps into it, not just the jump to default, but making jump processes models. And so we did basically using time changes. So we essentially took this whole business with diffusion-based models, and then we did a stochastic time change on them and constructed these classes of pure jump and jump diffusion models by time changing these diffusion models with jump to default by using Levy subordinators, so Levy processes with positive jumps to do the time change on them. So the interesting thing about those that you have this leverage effect in jumps. So people talk about leverage effect in diffusion models. So this is something very, very well known and well understood. So for example, constant elasticity of variance, let's say, local volatility is basically negative power of the stock price. So when the stock price drops, volatility goes up, so you get the skew. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, simplified view of the leverage effect. But if you look at all the jump models that are out there in the literature, they are mostly Levy-type jumps, and they are state homogeneous, okay? They're state independent. So the Levy measure is such that it's independent of where you are, where the current stock is. So by taking something like constant elasticity of variance diffusion that already has leverage effect in diffusion and subject to a time change, we actually get this jump models with leverage effect in jumps. So on that, so basically, as the stock price drops, it starts jumping more and jumping by bigger magnitudes. Okay, so that's leverage effect in jumps. So this is the paper that also appeared in Finance on extending this diffusion-based credit equity models to credit model equity models with jumps. So that's kind of the history. Okay, so that's why there is no mathematics here. I'm just basically doing a survey. And so now we're coming to this paper that basically I'm going to talk about is this new paper that, so the title is Constructing Markov Process with Dependent Jumps by Multivariate Subordination Application to Multi-Name Credit Equities Modeling. So what we're trying to do here, we're trying to ask a question. Okay, so in single name, everybody pretty much agrees that, well, obviously in an ideal world, perhaps you want to use some really nice structural models that are very sophisticated. But if you're doing reduced form, so something like reduced credit equity is the way to go, because you have the equity piece, you have the credit piece. But then when you go to multi-name again, so you have all the work on baskets, right? Equity baskets, exchange traded funds, which is all, again, if you look at the every individual stock, there, it's a process that keeps going. It's a positive process that does not allow the possibility of bankruptcy of one of the names in the basket, okay? And some of those exchange-traded funds, they're pretty concentrated. There might be 10 names in them, let's say, and they might be volatile and risky, okay? So what if you have an option on exchange-traded fund with, like, on 8 or 10 major companies, and let's say one or two go bankrupt? Well, all of the current existing basket models, okay, they don't have anything to say about this. They don't have anything to say about this because they all assume all the basket modeling that people do, and especially the literature, there's been a lot of literature in this area where people look at these arbitrages between individual options and individual companies and options on exchange-traded funds, for example. So there's a lot of this type of activity has been going on both in literature, academic literature, and in the industry. So I've never seen anybody, well, say, okay, what if you actually have some names disappear from the equity basket, okay? Now, of course, as soon as you go to multi-name credit derivatives, that's all people talk about, right? Because that's what they are about. They're about how many names default out of this basket, right? So you have the same type of disconnect between a multi-name world of sort of basket options, for example, and multi-name credit. And so the punchline here that we're trying to say that just like in the single name world, so perhaps it's time to look at some sort of a unified view of multi-name credit and equity, where you have both multi-name equity derivatives and multi-name credit viewed sort of in a unified way. So that's the punchline. So basically, we're going from this one, and the way we're going about it, so we're going about it from a univariate time change here to a multivariate time changes here, okay? So that's our mathematical mechanism. That's what we're actually going to do. Okay, so here's the model architecture. So we have N firms. We have N firms. And we're modeling defaultable stocks of N firms. So here are the, so I'll first go through the ingredients, and then I'll come back to the model architecture. So the ingredients we're starting with are as follows. N independent one-dimensional diffusions to get started. So they're independent to get started, okay, while they're diffusions. So, for example, jump to default extended constant elasticity of variance diffusions. So each of them can have this killing event in Markov process terminology, killing, so they'll have their own lifetime where the process terminates and jumps to a symmetry state using Markov process terminology. But at that point, to begin with, they started life as independent. So then we take a multivariate time change that is an n-dimensional Levy subordinator, okay, independent of the diffusions. Now, there is a huge literature in finance, like literally huge literature, about using one-dimensional subordinators to construct various models, starting from the original famous variance gamma model, where you take Brownian motion, you take a gamma time change, gamma subordinate, or subordinated, you get your variance gamma, then normal inverse Gaussian model, where you subordinate with inverse Gaussian subordinate in a huge, huge literature. Okay. Now, interestingly, there is very, very little literature on multivariate time changes. In fact, there is in mathematics literature, as far as I'm aware, there's like grand total of two papers, okay, in multivariate subordination. There is a paper by Barndorf, Nielsen, and Sato, not a very old one at that, maybe 10 years old or something like that, and also applied probability or advanced in applied probability, I don't remember, where basically what they did, they took, well, just like we know that if you take a Levy one-dimensional Levy process and subject it to a one-dimensional time change that is itself a Levy process, a positive Levy process, you get another Levy process. So Levy processes are basically invariant. The classes stay stable under these time changes. So they proved a similar result. And that classical result for univariate subordination is in every book. It's in Sato and Sato and everywhere, in every textbook, and in Kant and Tankov, in every single textbook. So basically in that paper by Barndorf, Nielsen, and Sato, so they proved that if you take N independent Levy processes and then you take an N-dimensional subordinator, and then what you do is you take each coordinate of that N-dimensional subordinator and time change each of those independent Levy processes with that coordinate. So what you get as an output is this bigger Levy process in the state space, which is basically a product space that has dependence now among components governed by the Levy measure of the subordinator. But again, if you started with Levy process and subordinated with multidimensional Levy subordinate, you get another Levy process. Okay, so that's basically what they proved. So that's not what we want to do, because we want to have all the state dependence, so we don't want to work with Levy process. And so basically, Raffer came up with, well, he was a PhD student at Northwestern, he basically came up with this idea. So this is Raffer's idea. He said, look, why don't we take our diffusions and why don't we do multi-name time change, where we take these diffusions that are not Levy and then subordinate each of them with a coordinate of this multi-dimensional subordinator. So what are we going to get? We didn't know. There's no math for this, okay? No mathematics for that at all at that point. So Raffer actually worked the whole thing on its own, on his own, so that was quite an impressive accomplishment for a student. He had some technical problems completing some proofs, and then we found out there is a very, very recent paper, like 2008, in functional analysis, like pure math. It's like on subordination of the title is multivariate subordination, subordination of groups of operators, okay? So we found it's not no connection at all with, actually doesn't even have much connection with probability theory. It's a pure functional analysis paper. But so it's one grand total of one paper, okay, that actually considers multivariate subordination of groups of operators. Univariate subordination is very well known. So it's a classical Bochner subordination. So there's a famous Phillips theorem. So if you take a one-parameter semigroup and you subordinate it with a subordinator, you get another semigroup, and so everything works out nicely, and you know what the generator is and everything. So it's very well-known classical result since the 50s. Multivariate result was non-existent. So basically, Raffo proved, almost proved, the multivariate version of Phillips' theorem with some difficulties to complete the proofs. And then at the same time, so we found it when he was at Northwestern, he was working on this 2007, 2008, and then we found this 2008 paper in functional analysis on in a more general setting of one-parameter groups of operators. So they basically proved that theorem. Okay, so without actually constructing processes, it was not a probability theory paper. It was just subordinating these groups of operators. So what we are doing here, we are constructing a multi-dimensional Markov process by taking an independent Markov process. So here, because I want to do credit equity modeling, I take these diffusions, but the paper has a much more general framework to it. It's basically constructing this class of Markov process. So here I start with n independent one-dimensional diffusions. I take this multivariate subordinator, n-dimensional subordinator. I take each of those diffusions, okay, and run it on its own clock, which is the coordinate of that multivariate subordinator. Now, because I want to have defaults for all those names, so I'm going to have also default times for these terms, and default times are going to arise from, remember that I'm going to start with these diffusions that have already killing in them, so there will be a killing rate. So again, in the Markov process terminology, so let's say it's there's some killing rate, there is some integral of the killing rate as a positive continuous ID functional. So now I'm going time change the whole thing, and initially, the killing times of each of those independent guys are obviously independent. After we do this big time change, so and it's actually quite delicate to time change the whole filtration and everything, so their respective default times are going to acquire dependence governed by the Levy measure of this multidimensional subordinator. So it really is quite an intricate. Quite an intricate model how this all works out. So, just to give an example, so these are the, so say, let's say we take n jump to default extended CEE models for each of those diffusions. So this is basically your diffusion process. You have local volatility for it, so for the CEV, constant statistical variance model, local volatility is basically a power function of the state variable. So if this power is negative, so that's this, you get the negative skew in that CEV. So this is the killing rate in the JDCEV model, in jump to default extended CEV model. So what we did in that paper, so originally this was introduced in that paper with Peter Carr, we took the killing rate, or think about it as default intensity, so it's not going to be the default intensity in this model, because after time change, the actual default intensity is going to look different, but in a pure diffusion model, that is the default intensity. So it's basically an affine function in local variance. Okay, so it's a constant that you can get rid of if you don't want to, and then it's a square of the local volatility that sits in the default intensity. Now, because in the CEE model, local volatility is really a power of the underlying state variable. For example, if X is a stock price, then you also get default intensity or killing rate is a power of the stock price. Okay, so that's the original diffusion model. So these are the model parameters here. So you have to obviously add this killing rate into the drift to make sure the whole thing is going to be a martingale, because you have to compensate for that jump to default. So you have to increment the drift, add the edit in the drift here. so this is the first ingredient. Okay, this independent processes. This is the second ingredient, the n-dimensional subordinator. So basically, n-dimensional subordinator is really an n-dimensional Levy process that increases in each of its coordinates. So that's what it is. So it has, by the Levy-Hinchin formula, so it has this Laplace exponent, that so in this case the Levy measure is n-dimensional here. So that is our multivariate time change. From practical standpoint, the classes of what are different ways you can construct those things, but the simple and easy way to construct examples of multivariate subordinators is something we call linear factor models. They look simple, but they are quite nice. So you basically take, so let's say you want an n-dimensional subordinator. Well, you can start with m, and m doesn't have to equal to n, independent one-dimensional subordinators, and mix them up with some matrix, okay? So you take a linear combination of them. So, for example, take m temperate stable processes, for example, or inverse Gaussian, or gamma, and then mix them up, and then this matrix is going to be basically is going to define the dependent structure on the Levy measure for this resulting n-dimensional subordinator with dependence. So this is something that we use for all practical examples, if all numerical examples. So we always use this type of structure. So the next item or ingredient in this model architecture is default times of each name. So default times are constructed as follows. So these are lifetimes or killing times of the original axis, of the original diffusions before the time change. So this is the usual thing. So we have this default intensity. These guys are unit mean independent exponential random variables. So the usual thing, so these guys are obviously independent because these are independent. The exponentials are independent and diffusions are independent. And then with time change the whole thing, and then in new time, so what default time is after the time change, so that's already the time when you have to time change your whole filtration, and then you come up with the new stopping times with respect to the time change filtration, so after the time change. So these are going to be the default times after the time change. This is also a little technicality here we introduced. So basically we stick in this extra parameter here. So this is just to make the whole thing a martingale. So and there is some condition on when this is, so we want obviously each of those under the equivalent martingale measure, we want to make sure that each of those stack processes net of assuming dividends reinvested and everything discounted, so we want them to be martingale, so that gives us some condition on the drift parameters, a technical condition that there is some integrability on that Levy measure, and then that fixes those rho constants. So then discounted x dividend stock prices are martingales. So that's basically the model architecture. Okay, so starting with n independent diffusions, subjecting them to this time change, multivariate time change, where we take Levy subordinator time change each coordinate according to a coordinate of the Levy process, and then we get an n-dimensional process which still turns out to be a Markov process, but with dependence. Now, dependence is among jumps. So one thing is, if you take a pure jump time change, then you get a pure jump process when you time change a diffusion. So, and the jumps are all dependent. If you also have drift in the subordinator, that will leave residual diffusion piece. Now, diffusion pieces are going to be independent, okay, because they start out as independent, but jumps are all dependent. Now, how do you work with this monstrosity, okay? So, the solution strategy, so basically it's two, there's analytical solution strategy and then numerical solution strategy. So, analytical solution strategy is quite nice in terms of the kind of mathematics is involved. So, basically what is happening here, so we're interested in pricing claims with payoffs that depend on n stocks. And now, both credit and equity derivatives look in the same way, okay, because the stock can now get down to zero. So if some of those stocks, they can be either positive at maturity, for example, of this claim, or they can be zero. So this encompasses both, for example, a basket option And also this encompasses something like ends to default swap or something else, but some multi-name credit derivative. So there's a little bit of combinatorics involved because it's not so simple here. What happens that some of your stocks may die and then the others keep going on, so this whole thing needs to be unwound, and so there is some inclusion-exclusion principle type calculation reduces the whole thing to basically calculating these types of expectations, where for each subset of firms, you have, so the payoff depends on the subset of firms, and this is, and you have an indicator function that particular subset survives. I haven't written down the formula, but it's basically rather standard inclusion-exclusion principle type calculation, combinatorics that gives you decomposition of an arbitrary payoff into items like this with some combinatorial coefficients. Okay, now items like this can be computed now by those semigroup results that I alluded to. So there's basically three things that are in play here. There is a general result, which is, so the Phillips theorem is basically in functional analysis, this is a classical thing. If you have a Banach space and you have a one-parameter semigroup of operators that, so you can subordinate, strongly continuous, you can, and if you take the subordinator, one-parameter Levy process. Well, again, if you talk about functional analysis, you don't even have to talk about process. You basically talk about the semigroup, a transition function of that Levy process, and then you construct a new object, which is this what is called Bochner's integral of that semigroup against the transition function of the Levy subordinator. Then the Phillips theorem tells you that the result is another one-parameter strongly continuous semigroup in the same Banach space. And from the Markov process standpoint, that generates a Markov process. And the Phillips theorem also gives you the expression for its infinitesimal generator and explicitly. So it's so that's general thing in Banach space. So now we want to actually do calculations. So to do calculations, we like to use spectral methods. So we like to use a subclass of Markov processes that are called symmetric Markov processes or M-symmetric Markov processes. So this is a special subclass of Markov process where you have some measure on the state space and the semigroups are symmetric with respect to that measure. And so this is then the Banach space becomes a Hilbert space. You can introduce linear product. So there is a whole big theory of symmetric Markov processes going back to the Fukushima's books, and there's a major abstract theory. So there are also some results on subordinating symmetric Markov processes with this particular paper that we used in one parameter case. So we are doing this in multi-parameter cases. Nobody ever done this in multi-parameter case. So, and then finally what we actually use for calculations, so as soon as I set Hilbert space and I set symmetric operators, symmetric semigroup. So we use spectral theorem to write down spectral representations for that thing. And here the situation is really interesting because, so it's a little bit of stuff comes in from the old days in quantum mechanics, okay, because you actually have multi names here. So it's not just the spectral theorem for a single operator, it's actually a spectral theorem for commuting families of self-adjoint operators. So this is like you have a set of observables that commute, and so you do the spectral analysis on that set. So that's kind of the little bit of physics comes from the old days. So these ingredients allow us to basically solve the beast analytically in some cases, okay, when we can do the program. So in particular, if you start with JDCV, so that can be done analytically quite easily. So the infinitesimal generator looks like this for a JDCV diffusion process. So this is basically just nothing but the diffusion. So this is the square of the volatility. This is your killing rate term, and this is your drift here, okay? So this can be rewritten. This differential operator can be rewritten in this formally self-adjoint form using something that is known as scale and speed densities. So this is how they look like in this case of this JDCV diffusion. And you can, in this particular case, you can define an inner product using this density against this density. So if you integrate two functions against this density, so you can define an L2 space. And then there is a spectral expansion, and this is explicitly how the eigenvalues of this operator look in eigenfunctions in that Hilbert space. Okay, it's basically Laguerre polynomials with some normalization constants, and there's some changes of variables involved. And the eigenvalues increase linearly in N, in the eigenvalue number. Okay, that's for one guy. Okay, that's for one JDCV diffusion. So now what this means in terms of computing expectations, so now you are, if you have a payoff F that you are evaluating at some time t, F of xt, so it's basically the same as computing the, so you can, that expectation operator is basically the this semigroup operator for the semigroup with this generator. And so basically this is how decomposition looks like, spectral decomposition looks like for expectation operators, so for the pricing operator. So basically what you do, you start with the payoff, you decompose the payoff in the basis of the eigenfunctions where the coefficients are basically inner products of the payoff and the basis function. So that, if you don't have this thing here, if you cross out this exponential, just sum of Cn phi n, so that's the decomposition of the payoff in that Hilbert space. Now, if you calculate present value, so the payoff is at time t, and you calculate the present value at time zero, the beauty is that because these guys here, they are eigenfunctions of the generator of the semigroup is diagonal, okay? All the semigroup does is just multiplies by the exponentials, okay? So you have the separation of time and separation of state variables, so very classical thing. So for you know, anybody who has done heat equations, et cetera, so this is all very familiar stuff. So now the interesting thing here is that when you do the time change, okay, with multivariate subordinator, so it turns out that, so you started out, so if we started out with n independent diffusions, and for each one we did the spectral decomposition, it's basically just the tensor product of the whole thing, right? So it's just going to be a product of this. Now, when we do this subordination, the eigenfunctions remain the same. What changes is the eigenvalues, okay? So this is the spectral expansion for the subordinate semigroup that comes out of from taking n semigroups on each of those spaces, building a tensor product, then doing the multidimensional subordination, and then doing the spectral analysis on the whole thing. So the eigenfunctions are basically the product of independent separate eigenfunctions. But then eigenvalues become quite interesting. So the eigenvalue, the new eigenvalue is you take the Laplace exponent of that multidimensional subordinator, okay, and it becomes a function of this original eigenvalues for the original processes. So this is how this multivariate subordination looks like. So I've never seen anybody in mathematics even, as I said, we did extensive search in pure mathematics literature, in functional analysis and in probability theory. The only paper we saw is this Banach space subordination of this one-parameter groups in Banach spaces. So they don't do any spectral because there's no inner product structure. So there's no Hilbert space structure. So this is what happens when you do it with the Hilbert space structure. So you have this nice thing. Mm-hmm. So this is a Laplace exponent. Okay, so this is the Laplace exponent for multi. So this is what it is. Okay, this is the this phi. So this is the function which is a multivariate. This is Laplace exponent of my n-dimensional subordinator. So basically, if you have the drift, then that's the drift, and then so this is the integral of your V measure. But of course, in many cases, you know this in closed form. Like if you you know this in closed form. So for example, if you started with the structure where you took, let's say, M temperate stable processes where you know the Laplace exponents and then you mix them up, so you construct that function explicitly, so it's not ugly. So you know, in many cases, you know them completely explicitly, this is the function. So again, interesting, there is a huge theory of Bernstein functions, right? So functions for, you know, Bernstein functions, basically, again, independently of probability theory, it's all analysis, right? They, for one-dimensional case, so there's a very, very nice recent book from last year by Schilling, Song, and Vondracek on Bernstein functions. One-dimensional, multi-dimensional is all completely open. So I've asked them, I've asked Song. So nobody, it hasn't been studied. So really, I mean, we do these examples, but it hasn't really been studied what these functions are in terms of n-dimensional case. So it's really quite fascinating. Anyway, so. Mm-hmm. Well, basically, if you have discrete spectrum, so I've written it in the discrete spectrum form, but it's general. If you have semigroups and Hilbert spaces, and I mean, you can write it for general spectral decomposition, right? Your spectral measure. So then you will have. Is it just because I'm using discrete spectrum as an example because I like to do the calculations? I don't want to have general continuous spectrum. I mean, I don't want to do multidimensional integration, numerical integration against that measure. Okay, so. That's why I do so. We like to work with, for example, trace class operators, so we have a nice discrete spectrum and everything. But this is very, you can write this in general form. So that's multivariate subordination. No. They've done Banach space. All they said is they just written down the representation for the generator and for the semigroup without any Hilbert space structure, without spectral. So this is, we did that. So we've never found anything. I mean, our paper is basically an applied paper, but we've searched and searched. We've never found up in pure math. And I mean, that's like 2008 paper by Meir Shayert, and they actually probability guys primarily, but they do semigroup stuff. And so they published that paper in a functional analysis. It's very obscure. It's like in a book. It's not even but that's the multidimensional generalization of that Phillips theorem, which is like a classic in every functional analysis, like textbook. So. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what are the dependences, right? The dependence is all through the eigenvalues. So the dependence all through the eigenvalues, because phi is the function of n variables. So that's the, see, what fascinates me about this whole thing is that you get this thing that it looks, analytically it looks very simple. I mean, the only dependence is, but sample path structure of the processes is drastically different. You start with n independent diffusions, and then you get this on, that's your input, and on our output, you get this basically a Markov semi-martingale that has this vastly dependent jump measure, where they all depend on how they jump, okay? And they jump, so not only that, they depend, their jumps depend on the states of each other. So, for example, if one stock is at 50 and the other stock falls to $5, so that stock actually knows and feels that the other stock is actually at $5, that it just experienced a big fall. So that's what the interesting thing is for this multi-name credit equity modeling stuff. So yeah, in terms of the Levy measure. Right. But obviously we want to mix them up, right? So obviously we want to mix them up. So that's why if you think of in terms of like Levy copula, for example, right? So we want them to mix them up. So we, in fact, this particular very simple structure of linear factor model, they mix them up. And, you know, you have a general matrix here, so you get fully dependent structure, even in this simple example. Okay, so since we are sort of out of time, so... just two words about simulation. So this is how the analytics works. Now, obviously, in practice, if you have for several assets, you can compute all this because there are multiple, just multi-dimensional sums here, and you have to truncate them if you compute the stuff. So we like trace class because then there's some, it's not just L2 expansion anymore. You can prove under some conditions that you actually have uniform convergence of this thing on compacts, and then you can actually truncate this uniformly controlling the error, and then you can compute the whole thing. But even under that, I mean, this is computational effort is going to grow on this thing. So if you have, you're not going to be able to compute many, many assets like that using this. Even though, you know, we have completely explicit expressions for the functions, for the eigenvalues, for this function, for coefficients, even in those cases, it's just going to be a huge number of terms. Okay, computationally, at some point, you're going to choke up on this. So simulation is trivial for this stuff, okay, because, I mean, not completely trivial, there's always tricks, but basically, you just simulate separately your multidimensional subordinator, and then you simulate separately your independent processes, diffusions, for example, a Markov process that you started with, and then you sample your processes at those random times that you have simulated, so you can simulate this very nicely. So just to conclude with a bunch of numerical graphs, just to show that you can actually compute the thing, okay, so you can actually get some stuff out of it. So this is some examples of correlations of stock returns and default indicator correlations. Okay, and this is just, so this is done for two stocks using inverse Gaussian subordinators and just varying some parameter in the inverse Gaussian subordinator. You can see that you can basically get various correlations you want. This gamma zero, that corresponds to pure jump case where the subordinator is pure jump. There is no drift. Then you can get as high any correlation between 0 and 1. So if you have drift in the subordinator, then you actually kind of have enough of upper bound on correlation because remember, diffusion pieces are independent. So again, this is unified credit equity, okay? So that's why we're looking at equity correlation and default correlation side by side. These are some survival probability calculations, single name survival, joint survival probability for two names. For two names surviving up until, for example, in this case, 1 year, as a function of stock price. Okay, so we can look at this thing. So this is a single name survival. So if the stock price is nice and high, so the survival probability is very close, and the lower the stock price falls, the lower the survival probability. And this is two-dimensional graph for two stocks. This is a picture of two-name default correlations and two-name stock return correlations as functions of stock prices side by side. This is some picture Rafa was playing with some ends to default kind of thing and distribution of the number of defaults. So this is, well, so this thing he actually crank out for 8 assets. He actually crank out all those sums because remember there's kind of two layers here. There is that inclusion-exclusion principle combinatorics to unwind the expectation in all of those subsets of to enumerate all the subsets of firms, and then you have this separate semigroup for each of the subsets, and then you have a spectral expansion for one. But he computed this for 8 names with relatively okay, but basket put is harder to compute. So this is for two names is easy, but then for many names it's hard because there's a lot of those terms involved. So anyway, so this is a basket put on two names as function of two stocks, and this fully accounts for the possibility that if one name dies, then the other name keeps going, and then the basket becomes, let's say if you have two names, then the basket becomes basically a single name option at that point, if one dies and the other survives. So this is simulation, so he's done simulation for baskets of, in this case, he's done 2, 10, and 20, so he estimated this basket put on simulation. This is pretty straightforward, so this is like 20 names, and that fully accounts for the possibility if out of 20 names, one defaults, so it becomes a basket on 19 names, one default. So in equity world, as far as I know, this is, I've never seen anything like that, where a basket option that allows for some stocks to die out and then the others to continue, okay? And this is entry default swap rates that he was computing for like first to default, second to default, so some numerical exercises. Anyway, so this is basically the paper. So the punchline is single name unified credit equity modeling is by now well established and sort of well accepted in the literature. So we are trying to say that you could also start looking at multi-name unified credit equity modeling and start looking at interplay of things like stock correlation and default correlation and start building models along those lines, the difficulties become substantially increased to build these types of models. And so this is our first attempt to construct something where we're using the tool of time changes that we know and like from a single name world, moving into multi-name world using this multi-dimensional subordination procedure. And you can get some interesting results on multi-name equity and multi-name credit derivatives within the framework on the same model. So basically, this is so this particular paper, this was the last chapter of Rafa's dissertation while he was at Northwestern, and it took a long time to clean it all up and write it all in a reasonable way, because there's all this mathematics that came into play that is quite interesting and has not been known for some reason, although it is, seems to be like a very classical thing, but has not been known, nonetheless. And then doing all this took a long time to. But anyway, the paper is available on SSRN, for example, and on Rafa's website. My website is so hopelessly out of date. At some point, I gave up on it. I have to get back into it. But Rafa is better at keeping up with this thing, so you can get it out of him. Okay, so I think we're reasonably.